1060 on House Bill 1645 and House Bill 1734.
The Oregon State Board of Health begins with a national licensing examination. This is an examination that is constructed and controlled by the cooperative efforts of the members of the State Board Council. This council is composed of one member from each state, the District of Columbia, Guam, and the Virgin Islands. The State Board Council established these national examinations in 1944 in its efforts to expedite interstate licensure permission and to improve the quality and validity of licensure examinations. The plan has been continued by the ANA Council State Boards of Nursing with the help and services of the National League for Nursing Test Construction Unit and the Evaluation Services. The ANA Committee of State Boards of Nursing appoints a committee on blueprint for licensing examinations. Composed of six persons employed by state boards from different geographical regions of the United States. Each year, this committee develops a core test plan for each series of professional and practical nurse examinations. Subject matter experts, item writers, are recommended by all state boards on an alternating basis to prepare suitable items for the test. Each item writer spends 1 week working with the NLM test construction staff to formulate questions in the area for specialty. The professional nursing examination includes five subjects: medical, surgical, obstetric, pediatric, and psychiatric nursing. Each paper includes 100 to 220 multiple choice questions designed not only to test specific knowledge, but also the ability to apply that knowledge in making judgments concerning the care of the patient. The Blueprint Committee reviews and compiles the work of the item writers, and a draft of the proposed questions is sent to each board of nursing. Under strict security regulations, the board members study the questions and indicate the items they believe should be retained, revised, or deleted. Constructive criticism of the entire document is given. Following a final review by the Blueprint Committee, the examination papers are printed in final form by the National League for Nursing. They are then distributed to the participating boards of nursing under signed contracts, which provide for security regulations and the financial agreement. The examination of practical nursing is developed in two parts, according to a similar plan. Knowledge and judgment necessary to pass this examination are in keeping with the minimum standards for practical nursing. 2 days are allowed for writing the examination in professional nursing and 1 day for the examination in practical nursing. The candidates' answer sheets are returned to the NLM for machine scoring, and statistical reports are sent to each board of nursing. The board studies the results and determines the minimum pass. Responsibility for determining the passing score and deciding whether or not the candidate may be safely granted licensure is thus carried by the individual board of nursing. Candidates who qualify are granted a license to practice. Others are advised about repeating the test in which they have failed. These examinations are revised each year. To further test and validate the questions used, candidates are asked to take a fixed consisting of 60 questions to be considered for the next series, which is not counted in determining their score. It is possible for a candidate to achieve a score in the 800s. The national theoretical mean is 500. Every state except two, and those are higher, have accepted 350 as a passing score. This is 1.5 standard deviations below the national mean. Each year, the examinations are standardized to enable boards to retain the passing score of 350. The following is a sample of the type of question which might be used on an examination of professional nursing. If a patient with diabetes mellitus becomes anxious and perspires and complains of weakness and hunger, which action is it important for the nurse to take first? Then there are five options for the person to choose from. Since the examinations cover five areas, states are only required to rewrite the area fail. In most instances, candidates pass on the second writing. Out of the 33 failures on the July examination this year, 29 passed on the second writing. 3 more passed on the third writing, leaving 1 candidate that was potentially successful. Each state signs a contract for the use of the examinations and for security measures. Among the provisions for security are controls for who may be present in the room when the examinations are written, and that once the board has accepted the contract, booklets are not to be seen by other than the official candidate. To have 10 practitioners review the relevance of the material covered in the next examination would be a breach of contractual agreement and be a security hazard. Loss of the use of the national examinations would penalize the state, as we will then have to set up our own examination. A study by the California Board estimated it would cost $30,000 to establish a fair and valid examination. In addition, Oregon graduates would no longer be considered for interstate endorsements and would have to write the national examination in another state to be licensed any place else except in Oregon. At one time, Texas did use their own examinations for the LPN, so these people always have that to write the national examination when they move to another state. And if examinations are given only 2 or 4 times a year, it might mean a delay of 2 to 6 months to receive a license. The following shows Oregon's standing in national examinations. From June 1969 to May 7, there were 40,967 candidates tested nationally. 334 of those were graduates of our Oregon program. I'm not going to, you've got in front of you the mean score of the state of Oregon and then the national mean below it. But if you will note that Oregon candidates ranked 11th in medical nursing, 3rd in surgical nursing, 8th in 3rd in nursing of children, 2nd in psychiatric nursing, and the failure rate for Oregon candidates there was 8% in comparison with the failure rate for 13% nationally. Then I've given you the year before that too, and you'll note that the Oregon failure rate was 5% with the national failure rate of 13%. Since 1944, when the State Board of Test School examinations were initiated, Oregon candidates have ranked in the top 10 states in achievement. And the next sheet shows what the practical nurses. 35,703 candidates tested from the fall of 69 through the fall of 70. 289 candidates from Oregon programs. They ranked 9th in the nation with a mean score of 543 compared to the national mean of 506.5. Failure rate for that year was 3.12%, and I've given you the year before, 68 to 69. We also believe that the procedure proposed in House Bill 1734 is not a valid way to test the effectiveness of the examination, nor to obtain a passing score. In a random selection of 10 nurses, it might be possible that the 10 nurses selected would achieve scores so high it would penalize the average young graduate, and the failure rate would be exceedingly high. Or the reverse might also be true. If the selectees would have such low scores that no one would fail. Having different passing scores for each examination would be patently unfair to the candidate. Although it is not possible with the present contract to admit any but bona fide applicants to the national examination, if it were possible, the cost to the board would be $110 each writing. This is only the direct cost of examination and does not include the hidden cost of selecting and notifying selectees, finding space for them in an already crowded situation, paying travel, and other costs. For every 35 candidates, we must have an additional proctor. The approximate cost of a proctor is $40 to $60 per examination. The variation depends on whether a board member acts as a proctor. With 500 candidates, we need 2 examiners and 15 proctors. The board members would be paid $20 per day plus expenses. The proctor would be paid an hourly rate for the 2 days. At the present time, the only space available to give the exams on the state property is room There's not space for more. In the early summer, when we have the largest number of applicants, we have to rent space in one of the public schools. This bill would jeopardize our using the State Board of Test and Licensing Examination and have serious consequences for graduates of our program, state licensure in other states. House Joint Resolution 26 to create an interim committee on professional and occupational licensing would permit this committee to evaluate the examination procedure of the various licensing agencies and determine those that restrict capable persons. Don't drop the baby with the bathwater.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
I yield to the sponsor.
I have no questions. So thank you very
thank
much.
You very much for coming.
Mr. Jacobson?
I'm Gordon Jacobson, Secretary of the State Board of Accountancy, representing the Oregon State Board, the Oregon Society of CPAs, and the Oregon Association of Public Accountants. And I think that rather than go through a lot of data that has been reasonably carefully prepared and as a demonstration of how well we do our work when we're properly licensed, I will leave this with the committee for their reading and be willing to answer any questions. If you don't have enough copies, I can give you some more.
No, this will be fine. Thank you. Are there any questions of the...
No, I don't have any questions.
Well, thank you very much for attending. We'll contact the rest of you at a later time. I think that's all from out of town on this bill. We'll close hearings on 1734 and open hearings on 1645. I'm going to ask here again that we take the people from out of town first. And the first witness is John R. Clough, Portland. I think in view of the lateness of the hour and the number of people testifying, if we can keep from being redundant, it would help a great deal.
Here's some copies of my testimony for the committee. My name is John H. Clough. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon, presently the director of the Trial and Appellate Division for Legal Aid Service in Portland. Skipping some of the biographical material, I'm presently counsel of record in two lawsuits that would be of interest to this committee. First is one that is presently in the United States Supreme Court attacking the constitutionality of the eviction law. The second is in the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon and also attacks the constitutionality of the eviction law, but more importantly, also seeks to establish warranties of habitability through common law, through case law, as it were, in Oregon. Now, in my capacity, I've been working in the area of housing law for about approximately 3 years. Roughly 12% of our cases of legal aid involve the housing field, and a large percentage of those cases involve clients who are dealing with landlords who are less than scrupulous. We recognize that not, you know, we're probably talking about a small percentage of landlords who I describe as being unscrupulous. But the changes sought in House Bill 1645 would be a step towards alleviating some of the problems faced by many of our clients and many persons across the state when dealing with landlords who are less than fair in their dealings with the tenant. We have more and more tenants, the tenant population. population is growing. It's the one of the largest classes of persons who are discriminated against in the law, in my mind, in the United States right now. And the reason for this is that for centuries, the law of landlord-tenant relationship has remained unchanged. This landlord-tenant law was developed in feudal times in England when a tenant rented a piece of property for the purpose of agriculture. He didn't care what was on it. The law didn't care what was on it in requiring the landlord to keep up, repair, whatever. Our society has changed drastically from that time, and it's time to look again at what the laws are regarding a landlord-tenant relationship. Essentially, a tenant nowadays is only interested in renting a home, a dwelling, apartment, house, whatever. He is concerned with one thing, that dwelling be in some kind of reasonable condition so that he may live in it, he and his family may live in it, with some degree of health and safety. Now, this is not the case. The 1960 census reflected there were 20% of the housing, the rental housing in Portland was substandard. I'm sure that through depreciation, deterioration over the last 10 years, that figure has increased. We'll find out when figures are released in the 1970 census. Now, some of these archaic concepts of the landlord-tenant law, where the tenant has really no rights, he is sort of the afterthought that's added to maintain a facade of an adversary proceeding, goes back as its own roots in English common law. This really apparent status of eviction law in Oregon at the present time, where the tenant has no ability to raise defenses. There are some codes that are enacted in various localities, there's state codes, local codes, whatever, that provide for minimum standards through safety, sanitation, fire, different types of codes. But we have an anomaly here because these codes aren't meaningfully enforced, and they're supposed to be what is minimum standard of decency, etc. And they're not enforced for several reasons. Agencies don't have the staff. The only means of enforcement are through compelling vacation of the premises or criminally sanctioning or fining the landlord. It's very difficult to think of the landlord in the traditional sense as being a criminal. And it's, the judges just don't regard a landlord that's brought before them in the same light as they would a criminal brought in the usual sense of the term. The eviction law literally helps landlords in if their intention is to continue to be operate in violation of the code by not permitting the ability to raise any defenses of this nature whatsoever. The occupants or the tenants have no legal recourse to independently enforce the codes. You can bring an action for breach of warranty, maybe for damages. That's fine. The low-income tenant is faced with needing a place to live. If he doesn't have that place to live, the right to damages after he's been kicked out of the premises, assuming that this case is valid, is rather meaningless because he's not going to look to the courts who did not protect him from being evicted and to give him an award for damages. This is the way that the situation is. Now, particularly noteworthy is the Turner Commission report on civil disorders, where it goes into at length the conditions that exist in the inner cities regarding deterioration of dwellings, code violations, and the people can see. They can see that the landlords who are in open and flagrant violation of the law do it with impunity. There's no recourse, and it's literally sanctioned by the institutions. And when we're talking in terms of law and order today, it's it sort of sounds rather hollow if we have a situation that affects tenants very basically in their home, and it's a weighted, unbalanced body of law that, you know, that law and order, well, you know, what law and order? The law and order that, you know, doesn't give us any remedy whatsoever. So this is the background of House Bill 1645. It's also the underlying background and the other tenant bills that are before the representatives of this session. It's an underlying question of whether or not the tenant has any right to be treated in a minimum standard of decency. Does he have any right as an individual? Now, just how this, to go about this, that's of course open to discussion. That's the underlying question. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Mr. Williamson, who is the testifier right following me, will explain specifically how the bill seeks to take one small step to help remedy the basic situation.
In what class of apartments do you see this problem most prevalent or most existent?
Low income.
Something that like welfare people might rent, or elderly, or?
Yes, anyone with a fixed annual income, a low fixed annual income. The problem is that they pay upwards of 50% of their income for dwelling. Ordinarily, when the bank is considering, you know, loaning money for a mortgage or whatever, they take 25%, considering the ability of an individual to pay. They're paying more, they're paying more dollars percentage-wise their income for their dwelling unit.
Are most of these in new structures or old structures?
Old.
All new.
Now, you have a difference between the building codes, which are in effect as of the time the dwelling was built. These are the health sanitation type codes, which are an upkeep or an ongoing type of code requirement.
What would you say would be the average rent fee? Do you have any idea?
Well, it varies, of course. We have we've had tenants who had 388 code violations in one place. Tenants were paying an average of $100 to $150 a month per apartment for the privilege of living in. It runs pretty close to $100 a month. I'm excluding the, you know, one-room apartment type situation.
What recourse do tenants have now, specifically?
None.
They can't go to the health officer or the
inspector? Oh, they can go.
The fire marshal?
Sure. They can go get inspection of the premises, and the fire marshal or whoever can go out and inspect. If he takes any action, condemns or gives the landlord notice to repair, there's only two things the departments and public agencies can do to enforce that: compel vacation of the premises or fine the landlord. They rarely take the second. If they take the first and the landlord still refuses to repair, then the tenant must move out. If the tenant, and he is on a fixed income, let's say, uses his money to repair so he can prevent getting thrown out by the city, he then can't pay his rent. He's evicted for non-payment of rent by the landlord. This is what happens in many situations. Oftentimes, the landlord, in retaliation for reporting of the tenant, the code violations, will evict.
If this bill were to pass and I were living in one of those apartments and I filed a true written notice with the landlord that I was going to have something done that needed repair, did I read it here? It says you file written notice, or do you have to file it? You just tell him?
Well, you have to provide some means of notice to the landlord. It's the basic problem that is inherent in all the states that have what they call a repair and deduct provision. California has it, Michigan has it. Give the landlord a reasonable opportunity to repair that situation. Now, that may vary. You know, could have a furnace going out in the middle of winter. It has to be some reason to do that. But this usually involves minor, you know, less than the amount of month rent or less than the fixed amount, $100.
What happens if I give him notice and he doesn't do anything about it? And under the provisions of just the...
Be entitled to go and have it done and deduct the amount from the next month's rent. Assuming that it was the type of condition that would qualify as being...
The landlord just still disagreed with that, then it would wind up in court?
Yes, probably would.
Thank you very much, Mr. Paul. Mr. Williams.
Thank you. Pass out just a brief summary of what the bill does. And I'd like to just briefly explain to you the section 2 of the bill basically applies a warranty of habitability. Landlord rents a dwelling with more than the tenant that the place is fit to live in. This a real property, personal property vendor makes a warranty that the goods he sells are fit for the purpose they're ordinarily used for. And this would simply extend the sort of basic concept of contract to landlord tenant area. This is probably the most crucial provision in this bill. One, applied warranty of tenant habitability. Second warranty would be that the premises comply with state with applicable laws. The third warranty in subsection C of section 2 is that they would warrant that they would make necessary repairs. The landlord would waive, the tenant could waive the right to have repairs made, they're free to do it himself. The Section 3 provides the remedies that a tenant would have in a situation if the premises are not habitable or if there's a breach of the code which substantially impair his dwelling for habitation, he can withhold rent. If he can make repairs, he can he can make repairs with his rent if he notifies the tenant, the landlord, and waits for 7 days. The notice does not have to be in writing under the bill right now, but on line 19, a written notice could be inserted between that sort of notice if the committee were to decide the right is necessary. The section 4 provides for places where you can get an inspector to come. In most parts of the state, you can't, but if you can get an inspector to come, a certificate of compliance or non-compliance would be prima facie evidence of that fact. Section 5 is sort of basic to the proper working of the bill. It would help us solve a big problem that, as Mr. Clough pointed out, is faced by tenants who try to enforce code. If they call the inspectors, they're summarily evicted. This would prevent this type of eviction, and it would provide that if an eviction occurs within a year after a tenant does take action under this bill or to get housing laws enforced, that it would be presumed to be a retaliatory eviction or a retaliatory rent increase. A landlord could easily overcome a presumption such as this, especially showing that the taxes have gone up, he's had to make repairs, the cost of business has gone up. And that's the reason he's raised rent or is evicting someone. It's just not a conclusory presumption provided by the bill. As I said, the most crucial thing in this bill, the thing that we really think is basic to the bill, is an extension of the doctrine that the premises are fit to be lived in. A list of states where a implied warranty is in effect, they're listed on the second page. They're not eastern states that are crammed with housing necessarily. And 5 western states have also passed repair and deduct corporate statutes, California, Montana, Minnesota, Oklahoma, repair and deduct. that's similar to this, the Model American Bar Association Act also contains provisions very similar to what we do with this bill. Further testimony, I guess, on some of the problems that we've solved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williamson. Are there questions, Mr. Williamson? Who drafted the bill?
It's been drafted by several. I've helped on it. Other attorneys in Legal Aid Service in Portland. There's been private attorneys in Portland that have worked on it. Parts of it are taken from the Model ABA Act and from other Model Acts.
How long can a tenant keep not paying his rent? Is there any time limit?
Under existing law?
Under this law.
If he's living in premises that are not habitable, and the landlord is in breach of the warranty, he can stop paying his rent, and he can stop paying his rent until he's evicted, theoretically, or until he leaves voluntarily. A landlord could evict him to make repairs of premises or to cease leasing.
What if the premises need such extensive repair that they are not habitable while the repair is being done?
He could be evicted for any logical business purpose. He just cannot be evicted in retaliation for withholding rent.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams.
Yes, sir.
Representative Roberts, did you intend to testify on this bill? Our next witness is Mayoa Cuida.
Deficiency, and they cannot complain or they will be evicted. While I fully realize that many dwellings do not become substandard because of the wrongdoings of the tenants, the law is still drastically slanted in favor of the landlord. The landlord business is wide open. Unlike most businesses and professions, you do not need a license to operate, and thus there is little control over landlords who violate the law. Landlords sometimes resist making repairs because they fear that the poor people to whom they rent don't deserve anything better. Absentee landlords who have other businesses oftentimes don't care about their property as long as they have their tax write-off. Nevertheless, most landlords are good, conscientious, and law-abiding. I want to make it clear that I am not anti-landlord, that if proposals were submitted to require tenants to comply with health, sanitation, and safety laws, I would be in favor of that too. Yet I do not think that HG 1645 will impose a hardship on the landlord. It may well help them, although they may not realize this. They will be far less likely to let their property deteriorate and far more likely to evict bad tenants and keep their property with the law. I have often suggested to tenants that they try and make necessary repairs and deduct the cost from their rent if they can obtain their landlord's permission. I believe HB 45 would provide a good means of getting needed repairs accomplished. While I recognize that the landlord is not always responsible for the negligence and deterioration resulting from the substandard dwelling, it has been my experience that most often, when a dwelling has been posted as unfit, it was a substandard dwelling prior to the commencement of the tenancy. Because of the condition of such dwellings, only the poor and the unfortunate who can afford nothing better usually become logical and almost inevitable occupants. While much stronger public enforcement of various health and sanitary codes are essential, if this problem is to be solved, the tenant also desperately needs and should be able to protect himself from the unscrupulous landlord who will allow his property to deteriorate in substandard conditions while he's occupied as a dwelling. House Bill 1645 would go a long way towards protecting tenants who attempt to see that their property does comply with the law and would be of significant benefit to the Multnomah County Bureau of Health in maintaining suitable housing in the Portland area.
Thank you very much, sir. The questions?
I have one. Mr. Kudo, the figures that you stated, 169 homes were unfit for occupancy in 1970, did that include the 90 dwellings also that were?
No.
They were improved in 90.
That's correct.
And reading over 1645, would you think it be possible to also include in HB 1645 a warranty that the tenants will also leave the property in the condition that they find it? Is that included in here in any place, or a reciprocal agreement so the tenants will also have an obligation as well as landlords?
Yeah, this particular bill, I specifically, I can leave it to the landlord as such, but it can be included. I think they can revise to include that if that's necessary. I can talk over to Mr. Williamson, the people who share the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Scott, are you from Salem or out of town? Please come.
Cover some of the history of landlord-tenant relationships, I'd like to just make the point that the reason for the state of the law that now is that in feudal times, the landlord-tenant relationship was basically a political relationship, and that's why the landlord is called the landlord. He was the tenant's government, and the rent was the taxes. And this has gradually evolved to being the economic or commercial relationship it is today, but we still have the principle that you have to pay your taxes, no matter whether the government is in services or not. And that's still built into the law of landlord-tenant.
You're not advocating we don't pay taxes, are you?
You can draw your own conclusion. We are saying that this is no longer a political relationship and it should not have the same, it should instead entitle the tenant to the same kind of rights as any other commercial buyer of property or buyer of a service should have. Some of the other testimonies describe the extent of the problem of deteriorated dwellings, and I'd like to point out one reason why this abuse has taken place. There are always some landlords, I suppose, who just are abusers, but that is a extremely small minority. The fact is that all the economic pressure on a landlord is not to rehabilitate his dwelling unit. The in most businesses, you would think that it ought to be the landlord's advantage to keep his property up in order to attract responsible tenants who are willing to pay adequate rent. In the real estate business, and in the case of more and more landlords today, these landlords are, particularly of low-income housing, are high-income professional people who are taking advantage of the federal tax deductions that are granted for interest on the mortgage and the rapid depreciation write-off. And by these, by obtaining these deductions, he can then subtract those from his other ordinary income to reduce that ordinary income. And even though the property is so poor that the rent doesn't provide him with a very good income, it offsets enough of his other income that it turns into a very reasonable return. You'll see, or in my business, lawyers get publications all the time from real estate dealers talking about how you can set your clients up in deals that will give them a 20% return or a 30% return on their investment, and will, because of the advantages that the tax law gives them.
Would we assume then that most unscrupulous landlords remember the Oregon Bar?
I'm afraid that too many of them are.
That was very good.
The absentee landlord, who is likely to have more and more of because of the advantages that I just described of being a part-time or an amateur landlord, is obviously the one who is going to be less interested in seeing to the upkeep of the place, because all of his advantages are other than selling, having an attractive product for sale. The return that comes to him is in getting the deductions and not in maintaining and improving property in order to attract a higher class of tenants. These are the landlords that will be hurt by this bill, and not the landlord who is conscientiously trying to provide a service to the public. I don't think the bill will have any serious consequences for a landlord who takes seriously the laws that are now in the books, the housing codes that are now in the books in the various localities. If a tenant fails to pay his rent, the landlord can still collect it or evict him, just the same as he can under the present law, under this bill, unless the tenant can actually prove that the premises are unfit to live in or in violation of the code. The fact that the objection may be raised that the words fit for human habitation are hard to interpret, I don't think they are, and we have already commercial provision. If the tenant does propose to deduct the cost of repairs from his rent, the landlord has a period of 7 days to repair. And if the tenant still fails to pay his rent, then the landlord is in no different position from a tenant who fails to pay his rent under the law as it now exists, except that the tenant can come in and prove that the premises were unfit for the for habitation or were in violation of the code. Therefore, the only right that the landlord really gives up, other than a right to collect rent regardless of the state of the premises, is that he has to stand ready to prove if he evicts the tenant that he had a good business reason for doing it. And that's the under your retaliatory eviction. And I don't think that's too big a burden to place on the landlord in order to give a very substantial number of rights to an underprivileged class of people. Basically, the law is designed, demo forum fields, to provide equal opportunity for, provide an equal footing under the law for all the parties to a legal relationship. And this is the, all we're doing is trying to draw some fair rules for the game and not trying to help out one group at the expense of the other.
Could you give me some examples of what you might classify as unfitness?
Well, I would think that a premises that had a roof that leaked so that the tenants were unable to stay dry, premises where the furnace didn't work or where there were holes in the walls, this kind of thing that you see, so that the premises were unable to be heated. I suppose you might get into some kind of a closed case where there's a question of whether, you know, you don't repair some tile in the bathroom that's fallen off, and there will inevitably be areas like this where the question is, does this make it unfit to live or doesn't it? And it will require some interpretation from our courts and gradual development of the law. However, I would point out that this works to the advantage of the landlord because the burden is on the tenant to prove that the place is unfit to live. And if he takes a chance of withholding the rent, he's taking a pretty big chance because the place may, if it really is that close a question, I don't think it's worth the land, worth the tenant's risk he'd be taking.
What would happen if in a, say, a hypothetical situation, this isn't too hypothetical, this happened in my area in Southern Oregon, a man left his back door open, closed the screen door, turned his sprinkler on in the backyard, didn't really think too much about it, except the water went in and shorted out a $900 electric heater. Whose responsibility is that to replace it?
Well, under this bill, the, I think in section 2, C, you'll see that the the obligation doesn't apply where the disrepair or violation of the law regulation has been willfully or negligently caused by the conduct or omission of the tenant, his licensee, or indirect fee. The landlord's warranty of habitability, of course, wouldn't apply to that situation because he's simply warranting, he's not warranting. I think under traditional common law principles of warranty, that's a condition that's caused by the beneficiary of the warranty would not be give rise to that liability.
Yes, I'm trying to place somehow place the blame on these unscrupulous landlords, and you made a statement, I believe, that most landlords are high-income people. I assume you mean most landlords of these type of dwellings we're trying to get at are high-income people.
I couldn't tell you, and I didn't, correct me if I did, say that most landlords are high-income people. It's apparent, I think, to anyone who's looking at the area, there's an increasing number landlords who are going into the business to take advantage of the people. And
we established these were attorneys, didn't we?
Many of them are. Many of them are doctors. The high income property is not as attractive because then the maintenance and so forth and go with it.
Yes, I understand it. I just wonder if you had any statistics.
No, I have no statistics. I will give you, they have some statistical backup. Some of the information is from the National Commission on Urban Problems, President Johnson, which issued a report, the federal income tax in relation to housing, that is reported in this issue of the American Bar Association's taxation section. Bulletin that is specifically directed toward income tax reform, but it points out the relationship between the tax advantages and the and how those tax advantages actually tend to accelerate the deterioration of housing.
One other question, another hypothetical situation. If you had a building, say, with 100 tenants or 100 rental units in it, and they all got together and decided to withhold their rent for some reasons possibly given in HB 1645. The landlord decided that they were all unfounded reasons. They wanted to evict all of them. Wouldn't it be entirely possible, because under that circumstance, the burden of proof would be on the landlord. He could have 100 separate cases pending in courts. Whether the reasons were justified or not, he'd have to go to court on each one of those.
Well, I suppose that could be true. And if you have a 100 tenants who are willing to withhold their rent in that situation, it seems unlikely that the complaint is unfounded, but possible. I suppose it would introduce a burden on a very large landlord under that situation. You go into a 100-unit apartment house, I think you're taking on, asking for a larger number of legal relationships with different people than you are when you well. I think that the landlord quite possibly could achieve some consolidation in those cases, and the court that applies to under procedural rule.
I think we cannot assume that all, no more than we can assume that all landlords are crooked. We cannot either assume that all tenants are honest. And I can see that the possibility exists that some type of conspiracy could,
the drafters of this bill have that very much in mind. The fact, what does this bill do to a good landlord and a bad tenant? And have tried very hard to place as little burden as possible on that landlord. And I think maybe you hit a situation where if these tenants did that for some whatever reason, which we just assume they're 100 bad people tenants, it would make it hard for them.
Right. Just trying to isolate the situation so that it's not going to be putting a real burden on the honest landlords. If there's some way that we could eliminate these people that you're discussing and talking about.
No, I think we will do so without placing any significant burden on them.
Mr. Scott, would you be amenable to an amendment to this bill which would set up standards for tenants too?
as far as it would all have to depend on what they were.
Relative to upkeep and fire and plumbing fixtures, etc. The use of the property, in other words.
Well, they have those in any ordinary lease. The tenant usually has a duty to keep up the premise. As far as implying that in every lease, if you wanted to divide up for the party what their responsibilities would be, I would have.
Thank you, Mr.
I think there's a difference here because, yes, a landlord has a certain amount of recourse, except the burden of proof is literally on his back. Because if I live in an apartment and I set a hot pan on the drain board and burn the what am I trying to say?
Countertop.
This is a bachelor speaking.
The countertop. Today hasn't been my day. The countertop up, and the landlord comes in and says, well, it's your responsibility to fix it. It was negligence on your part. Yes, it was. And I move out the next day. He has to come and find me. He has to collect for me. He has to take me to court.
That's right.
Well.
You have a rent deposit ordinarily. I mean, that's
Do you have a rent deposit in these low district, low rent?
Very much so.
You do?
I have no experience. I couldn't tell you that representatives from legal aid proponents could tell you. My understanding that there are, but
undoubtedly we have more testimony on this subject. Right. Thank you, Mr. Scott. I appreciate your efforts to keep from being redundant on this. Mr. Rosenkranz.
I have some testimony of Mr. Richard Brunell, who couldn't show up today. He was manager of a series of apartments that I was involved in a suit with. And I also have with me some pictures which I took in these apartments that were involved in the suit. I'm afraid I only have two copies of them, so I'll have to share them. In the interest of brevity, of course, I won't read the statements, but briefly what went on is that there were 10 dwellings that were involved in litigation against the landlord for refusal to repair over 350 code violations cited by the separate housing, building, plumbing, electrical, and health code inspectors of the city of Portland. And I lived in my apartment for a year and a half before I had a house I could take. And after a year of living in the apartments, we filed a suit. They're all getting eviction notices, and the president is fighting the eviction notices right now in the state Supreme Court. The landlord repeatedly promised to repair things and never did. We were not allowed to deduct from our rent. I paid myself $150 a month for a two-bedroom flat. Plaster falling out of the ceiling, faulty plumbing, windows cracked, the heat would go off during the winter. Porch railing unsafe, the porch is about 8 feet off the ground. I could do nothing with the law. The law just gave me no weakness.
Are there any questions? Who are you? Are you Mr. Rosenkranz?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. The testimony comes from Mr. Reinhold.
I sent out two
plus copies. The others. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are there any testimony, any questions, Mr. Rosenkranz?
As a matter of the deposit coming up. I had to pay a third of my rent down the deposit, $50 a month, which I doubt we'll ever see again.
You don't have any comments about the bill itself? Have you researched the bill?
About the bill, like I mentioned, I had no legal recourse. I could do nothing to force the landlord to repair, and I couldn't deduct because then I would be breaking the lease, I wouldn't be paying the rent, and I'd be thrown out. And we just tried everything we could do. The landlord is a criminal. The landlord is obviously a criminal. Our house was unsafe to live in, and there was absolutely nothing we could do. This law would allow us to either repair and deduct, or it would give the city inspectors a little more license to force the landlord to comply with their set of codes. passing of Bill 1645 would give me personally a recourse to the law that I don't have. And my own respect for the law has decreased because of the situation that I've been involved in.
Were these matters brought to the attention of the health authorities in Portland?
Housing authorities?
The health authorities in Portland.
Yeah, we brought them. We had several visits from the housing inspectors, fire inspector, electrical inspector. Mr. Cooter testified previously for the health and safety department. And many of them had been there before. They'd been there often. They knew the apartment, they knew the landlord, there's nothing they could do. It's an area near Portland State. A lot of the houses in the area are being torn down because there's a high demand for vacancy. It was near downtown. It's convenient for my work. And that's why I wanted to live there. But it just became unbearable.
You're not there now?
No, I moved. I found a house three times the size for a less rent.
Did you get any rebate on your rent, Bob?
No. Still in the courts. We had a post to appeal this case. We had a post, according to the FED statute, a double rent bond, which came to $14,000 worth of blue chip stock, and put it up as collateral, and the insurance company wouldn't even bond it. They wouldn't touch it. So we had to bond ourselves.
Are there any more questions, Mr. Rosenkranz? Thank you very much. Mr. Is it Abell? A-B-E-L-L?
Yes, I guess. Mr. Chairman, I'm representative from Portland, representing several associations. Following the opponent's recommend tabling the House bill or drastic revision of moderation. Representation comes from Portland Housing Association, Portland Alumni Family Housing Association, Randall Construction, Cooley Construction, Edwards Industries, Wally Shores, Lamb's Homes, Property Management Services, Karen Timber, Irwin Abel, Lane Whipple, Homeland Incorporated. By testimony so far, it appears from some of the notes that I've just jotted, and we'll get into the House bill a little later, that the tenants now presently have recourse by phoning inspectors in the electrical division or fire inspector or health safety. So they do have recourse, and I think by having such people out that they could put a tremendous amount of pressure on it. So this is number one. I think that they do have a recourse, and being in a liar's position, as the witnesses so far have been, that they would recommend this kind of action immediately, and should support this kind of action. It seems to me this bill, by what they have said and some of the questions you've asked, that they've hesitated and haven't had their answers. It seems this bill can be easily construed, which we will point out. And also, a landlord presently owning homes that say a freeway is going to be going through and it's being rezoned and the home's going to be torn down. The waiting time of this might be a year, maybe 2 years. And to leave the house empty for that length of time is a loss to the owner. They've not settled for price. It's going through probably some debate in court. And having tenants in it is a good point, and they've got to make the money, and yet it's not worth putting thousands of dollars into it. So rezoning and the purpose of the land, I think, should be in the good of it. And I think that this will duplicate other government programs that are now presently being looked at and implemented. We have the 235 and the 236, which will help resolve this particular problem. I think that this bill would withdraw a great sector of low-house renting because of the fear of certain landlords because it is not a just bill the way it stands. The other thing is, it does kill initiative and motivation upon the individuals that are renting. This particular person I witnessed here prior to myself, it would appear that through motivation and ambition and a little ideal in him, that he could overcome some of these problems rather than taking a negative recourse. It's always seemed to me that a positive attitude towards your tenant will give better results. So people that are having problems with idealism, I think that when I was living in this area, and I can say back in Canada, realistically, it was then, and I could see the ideas that I was going to get on top rather than handle them or endure them. I think that we should look at perhaps one more hypothetical case that I just had. It's not a hypothetical case. We just bought an apartment building that's 10 years old. We had 25 units in it. This particular apartment building has three lawyers, a doctor, has two Portland State professors, and one engineer. One night I got a phone call and they said that they had gotten with the manager and they were going to have a discussion. 2 weeks after we bought the property, and I was invited. I went to the discussion and they had a sit-in. When we bought the property, we inspected it to see what condition it was in, and we found that many of the subfloors were rotting out around the toilets, and so we were going to replace it, put down a new linoleum. And that certain areas of the roof, the venting was not proper, and it was starting to rot out. So we immediately put in teams of people to start to repair this. They had to sit in, and they said, we don't want to repair, because if you do, you're going to raise our rent. Many of these people have been there 6 years, and the high caliber that they were, we thought that we were doing a real great justice toward them, putting thousands of dollars into this place. And we did not raise their rent, did not even plan on it, and then they had a sit-in telling us that they were going to run it a certain way. So I told them that if they would sign a certain paper, that they would not have sit-ins and not create problems, that we would hold up our end of the bargain. They did not even sign any kind of agreement with them. So it shows that tenants can gang up even when there isn't laws. Also, just this last storm indicated the same place we had, it's got a large court and a fountain, and there was two cherry trees blew over. And so the next day, we went out to repair, and we had several men go out, and they couldn't get the cherry trees up. We had to bring in a cat and a crane. And we were threatened by several of the tenants that they were going to withhold rent until such time the place was fixed up and put back in a presentable position, and that they wanted the trees saved, that we could not cut them apart, and that if they didn't, that they were going to threaten that we had to put new trees back in. So they do have a little pressure on the other. It seems to me that this is the purpose of this bill, to create an equitable responsibility between tenant and the landlord for the
inhabitable.
Thank you. Of the dwelling. And on that basis, in section 1 of Mouthful 1645, it says, or a portion thereof. This becomes ambiguous and is not always qualified as a residence or a portion for habitation. And in section 2A, it has all common areas, which by certain unscrupulous tenants could be construed to mean kennels, areas for livestock or pets, or barns, or gatherings, silos, etc. And in section 2B, I think mention should be made for reasonable modification and in accord with general practices. It should be allowed for age and location of certain dwellings. And there is not usually a code for maintenance. And if alteration or improvement is being undertaken, permits are usually necessary. So I think that they've extended that particular thing beyond reason. There should be an allowance for minor nuisances and tenant responsibilities for general care and maintenance of the tenant. I think the section 2, paragraph 3, this section shall be liberally construed. That ought to be totally.
Ought to be what?
It should be taken out. This section shall be liberally construed. I believe that should come right out. Section 3, paragraph 2b, it says some standard for reasonable should be indicated so not every problem becomes a court case. Section 3, paragraph 3, I think this time should extend to 1 year, or the present amount could conceivably be as much as 75% of 1 year's income of the company. This could cause bankruptcy unless there is a controlling factor. Notice of failure to comply should be in writing 7 days, writing, and 7 days should be extended to 30 days, and yet for an emergency, the time should become of an essence. Section 4, the burden of proof of non-compliance or failure to perform covenants and warranties should be upon the tenant because he does have recourse to our present programs. Section 5, evict should be extended, evict or serve notice. I think I'm copying their case at this point. Section 5, number 2, 30 days instead of 1 year time limit, which allows a 60-day period before they would have to move.
You have copies of these?
Yes, I do. Also should have a section to provide for a dwelling rendered unattainable by fire or casualty. The leaser or leasee has his option to terminate the lease, and also that the leasee further understands he is responsible for obtaining insurance protection to cover his personal belongings. Also, any failure of leasee to pay rent upon completion of repairs and promptly when due thereafter, or if leases shall fail to perform said covenants contained herein, the leaser may, at his option, terminate the tenant to enter the premises. I think on that basis, the bill would be much more equitable, but as it stands, I think it ought to be taken. I do have copies of this.
Are there questions of the witness?
You mentioned the number of times or twice, I believe it was, if the tenants do have recourse, can you tell me the procedure for one of the an apartment house that was really falling apart? What their recourse is? What steps do they go through in order to get the facility repaired?
Well, normally the first is to contact your landlord. Secondly, is you can talk to other tenants. Should there be other tenants close by, and you can discuss it and put more pressure on the landlord. Thirdly, there is a withholding period of rent, which you can go up to 20 days under our present landlord lien law and put a tremendous amount of pressure on the landlord before any action has to be taken. You cannot evict on that basis.
There's a current landlord lien law, is that what it's called?
Yes. And fourthly, you can call in city inspectors. And fifth, you can take it to court through legal aid.
We've had some testimony, I believe, that sometimes these are taken to court and the judge says there's no law that can compel a landlord to repair a tenant's dwelling, so there's no action that can officially be taken. Is that true or is that untrue?
I don't know. I do know that this particular industry is a marketing industry. We have to, if you're going to, like they said, have this as a lucrative thing, you've got to merchandise. You've got to be able to sell your product. On each basis, I think it's only good business to upgrade or to keep it tenable. Could I give you one more illustration of something that has occurred? You brought it to mind. And, we had a case like this where there was a duplex, and this one gal, some unknown reason, her children or somehow the toilet got plugged, seemed like every month. And so, in the course of this thing, it would run over, and she would not pay much attention to it. And I had gone out personally and scraped things off the floor and cleaned it up. But in the course of the time, the water ran down past the tub and some of the tile down below the building. It wasn't about 3 or 4 months we had a rat problem. know all of this was happening until the tenant next door, and then I phoned and said, we got rats. So immediately I phoned a pest control and we went out to observe what had happened. Well, after the course of 6 months, we found that the subfloor had laminated and became spongy. The toilet itself had started to sink for about 4 inches, and it had broken some of the plumbing. And we had acquired the rats. We had rotted rooms in the place. And so it came down to that because of her negligence, we had an uninhabitable building. And we went out and, without charge, repaired it, fixed it up, put her back in shape. Now, I'm not saying that every tenant would do this. But the fact of it is, it can be negligence on their part, not reporting some problem that could create thousands of dollars worth of damage.
Did you keep the tenant?
Yes, we did.
Previous testimony also indicated that renters had called inspectors to come and look at the premises, and nothing happened. Do you have any comment on this?
I would say that probably they did not present the case properly then to the inspector. We build about 700 units a year, and I manage about 1,000. And the inspection services are always willing to help us out on any problem. And if tenants go as far as calling in an inspector, boy, we ought to. I mean, that's... in the course of 7 years of management, we never had a long case.
Take me a little farther on this about landlords who do not comply with the requests or the orders of the inspectors. What happens then?
If the inspector has made out a certification or has forced the tenant to take out a permit, then it's just normal recourse to follow through that it's done. And if it's not done, of course, then it's a bond down in the inspection service.
Well, the previous witness testified that they'd gone through all this rigmarole and nothing had happened. I'm sorry he's gone, but...
But this, I know that when inspectors get on us, and we just had a case where a heating inspector, with a brand new duplex, FHA, passed all codes, and the heating inspector was called out by one of the tenants. And being electric heat, all the walls were turning black. And the fridge, where it was cold, and on the certain, or on the tank, the stool, that had all turned black, and it was just a carbon deposit all over. So I went out, I was a little panicky that something was wrong. I checked the vents, and we couldn't find a thing that was wrong. The heating inspector and I, and all of a sudden, we walked by the television, and we saw that one wall was all splattered with wax. And so we looked around and we found a large candle that had a couple straps, and it was a big wax candle like this that they had made into multicolors. And apparently the wax in a great big wick that was about an inch through was creating such amount of soot in the building or in that apartment. It was going through the heating system and had discolored the whole place. So it meant repainting it.
Pardon me? You repainted gray.
But the inspector, you see, came out and put enough pressure on us that we had to go out there and spend probably 3 or 4 hours trying to locate a problem that was illogical to us.
I'm not getting an answer to my question, Senator. What I'm asking you is, what force of law stands behind the inspectors?
Sorry, I don't know.
You know?
Yes, sir. The Bureau of Health puts on a sign and put for human habitation and closes it down. Now, I'd like to speak in regards to the gentleman
that left. That was Rosencrantz. Patrick Rosencrantz.
Size.
Now, if it is the ultimate control is to evict the tenant, it's reported. So if the landlord doesn't evict them, it'll be the housing authority that evicts them under the existing law. Secondly, there's still a 20-day grace period for eviction. If you're 10 days behind your rent, you're evicted, regardless of what kind of code efficiency the common cost of the landlord is. You've been paid that rent to evict them, and that
okay, thank you. Are there any more questions of Mr. Abel? Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Wilbert.
No. I'm Bill Wilbert in Warren. I have an apartment rental unit in Portland. I am on Portland housing, local housing association committee. There's just a few things here. This bill is designed to alleviate a few problems in the housing business, and it'll create numerous more problems with a legitimate owner. I'll give you an example. The project I now have has 155 units in it. We're having a water problem. It's 5 years old. And I spent about $3,000 to date trying to alleviate it. We're having excessive corrosion in the hot water system. We get warm water to some of the buildings, but not excessively hot water. I had a tenant call me this morning threatening to do something in the way it was holding back. We're doing what we can. I hired an electrologist engineer. He put in a rectifier in the hot water system. It's usable hot water. I mean, it's warm enough to wash for most people, but some of them want it hot. We start out at the boiler at 180 degrees. We get to the buildings maybe 90 degrees in some apartments, which is their desire, not warm. If it's along like this, when it will affect these tenants that all get together and withhold their rent, next week I'm going to install a circulating faucet one off the faucet. This has been going on for about 6 months, and we've been working on it. We're bringing the pipes out with a snake, this sort of thing. Now, this is one instance. Now, this happens in legitimate, good housing today. Try to relieve it, but if you give a law like this to a tenant, he'll be able to come in and withhold his rent after 6 months when the problem starts to show, and he could bankrupt the owner in 6 months by withholding all of the tenants. All my tenants got together and said, well, our water isn't hot enough. They could put me out of business. And I'm trying to fix it. I can't fix it. I've tried, and I'm still working on it. I've got people working on it. And now this is just one instance. There are several instances that occur in housing where a leak grew up or something cannot be, the remedy cannot be found immediately, and an honest landlord is trying to remedy it. But if you put this type of restriction where the tenant can withhold a minimum problem develop, you're going to bankrupt. Another thing, there were some questions asked that I might be able to answer. Here on this electric heater example that was given earlier, where a tenant caused the damage, by the time the owner is aware of some defect, such as an electric heater or a heating unit, the story isn't always presented to him the way it happened. They say the thing isn't working, you fix it. Now, they isn't told that the tenant was the cause of it becoming inoperative. And therefore, these things, if the tenant has the power to withhold rent, he's going to claim that it's the owner's fault and withhold his rent until it's fixed. And the owner doesn't have much recourse to it. The big factor, I think, here that threw this whole bill out is that all of these people are talking about low-rent housing, and that if you bring these up to standard, the tenant couldn't afford the rent. Therefore, you're going to withdraw this type of housing off the market. The owner is going to be afraid to rent it. And you're going to have a much bigger housing problem than if you go through the existing laws and through the existing programs that are now in operation. Now in Portland, the Public Housing Authority is building considerably new homes just for these people around the city of Portland. There's a new FHA program, which is a rent supplement program, going in and getting qualified quarters, and when these people cannot afford to pay the going rate for that quarter, say a third or 20%, and these programs are being accelerated. They can't be done overnight, but they're in effect, and they're available to all communities. assist the landlord more than it will alleviate the problem for the people that are here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilbur. Lee, Pat? I don't think there are any questions. Thank you. Mr. Spears? A bill that we can accept, will you?
I think actually to go back to one of the attorneys, try to adopt with our existing real estate laws originated in the feudal system days. This is true enough, but primarily it was originated so the tenants would have rights, and it was done for the purpose of giving rights to tenants. And one of the major things that is being overlooked, I believe, in this whole thing is the fact that ownership of a piece of property consists of a bundle of rights. One of these rights is the right of tenancy. You can give up the right of tenancy and still retain ownership. But when you give up the right of tenancy, you can do it in one of two ways, either on a leasehold. Now, if it's on a leasehold, all leases that I have ever read or that I have ever done, helped to put into existence, have all contained clauses that state the property owner or the landlord is responsible for the repair and upkeep of the material real estate. So this is an enforceable existing situation. On a month-to-month tenancy, the tenant acquires the right of possession, but on a very, very temporary basis, 30 days at a time. Now he is taking a right that the owner gives him, and he is contributing for this right approximately 1/200th of the dollar value of that particular piece of property. So the owner has invested a large sum of money, even in relation to the amount of rent that the tenant is paying at least. And in all sincerity, I think that it still comes down to the low-income rental housing situation. And if this bill is enacted, it will be actually detrimental to the tenant because the landlord that owns these buildings has invested probably all of the money that he can afford to do so. And one of the reasons that it is in disrepair is because through the years the tenants have neglected to keep it out of the home. They had no interest in the property, so therefore they could care less what happened next month. And this month the building deteriorated. Now, if the rents were withheld in the amount of 25%, in many cases the landowner would have to close these habitations. So they're substandard. They are also substandard in the price of the rental property. Frankly, I wish I had some property. I'm just glancing at the pictures that could bring in $150 a month. I wouldn't pay that kind of rent for that place. And anyone that would live there is doing so, and I believe it was finally admitted, at his own desire and his own request. The building could have been shut down by public inspection, yet he is willingly paying higher than standard rent for that place, and he is willingly living there, and he has the right to move at any time he so desires. I'm going to read just about 3 or 4 paragraphs of this. The landlord who attempts to rent property for a rental amount greater than the condition that rental unit warrants will automatically suffer a financial loss as great or greater than those proposed through loss of income or lack of tenants until he either repairs the property or reduces the rent to a level compatible to the tenant that will accept that rental on inspection. This then reduces to individual instances in enforceable law, the law of economics. Regardless of the dreams of a few well-meaning individuals, it is an existing and absolute fact that there are now and always will be mansions and slums and graduated levels in between, and that each person will seek his level according to his desires, ability, and possibly a divine intervention uncontrollable by any man. If the proposed laws are enforced, it will cause many landlords to close habitations not available at all levels because they cannot afford to upgrade them to a level acceptable, not to the tenant willing to live there and able to afford the existing rent, but acceptable to some insane individual who wouldn't live there even if it were upgraded. So it's still a situation of dollars and cents, if you will. The person that can afford to pay the good rent will live in a house that is automatically kept in good repair because the owner permits it to go into disrepair, he loses his tenant and his income. When he loses his income, he loses his property. There are very, very few property owners that can hold that property as an owner unless he has the rents coming in to pay the mortgage, the taxes, and various other expenses of that property.
Mr. Spears, are you saying that there are no scrupulous landlords in the city of Portland?
No, sir. I am simply saying that if this bill is enacted, it will not only affect those unscrupulous landlords and those unscrupulous tenants, it will affect all landlords and all tenants, and it will open the door to the tenant who today, maybe he's a little unhappy with the color of the paint on the walls, or possibly there's a real slight drip in the faucet that could be repaired with a 15-cent washer, but he decides that instead of that, he wants a new faucet. So this is opening a door to bankruptcy, really what it boils down to. It will be giving the tenant that normally is happy with his home the right to spend every third month, and including that, in better condition. The end result is going to be that the landlord is going to raise his rent by 25%.
So you do recognize that there is a problem, though, as far as
there are
the landlord
problems. Yes, but it is not an industrial. It's not an industry problem. There is a social economic problem. But in this situation, it's like cutting off your neck to get a wart on your thumb. It's about the same proportion. Again, on the same situation, I have one instance of a dwelling, a three-bedroom residential dwelling, single unit, that is leased to CAP, the Housing Authority of Portland. In the last 2 years, there has been $1,800 spent in repairs in that building. Now the rent is subsidized by the city of Portland for low-income housing. Yet out of this $1,800 that was spent for repairs in that building, $100 of it was spent for a stolen refrigerator, and the balance of it was destructive acts of the tenants that had been in there for over the years. Now, again, there is nothing that prohibits in this bill a tenant living just about as he wishes. If he thinks in the wall, I'm sorry, my luck come out and just up. It's not, it will not accomplish what they want by giving better living conditions to the low standards of living people. It will not increase their living at all. But it can make a very definite financial hazard to all of the industry. And in return, again, as I say, I'm speaking for the tenants, because if it happens, the landlord is going to automatically raise his rent, not to the poor tenant only, but he'll have to raise it to all of them, just when he off chance that he's going to get stuck for about 25% of the income. Questions?
You made a statement in your printed testimony. If I can quote it, with 5 minutes of mature thought, it should be realized such laws are not necessary, for they already exist as an economically enforceable fact. Is this what you're alluding to when you say it's a socioeconomic problem?
You say you represent both sides. You want to tell us what's good about the bill?
The bill, as far as I can see, I hate to put it this way, but I can't see anything good about the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chris. I can't read the next name, LB something or RB maybe.
Could I indulge you in about 2 more minutes?
Order.
Yes.
He reminded me of something. I have management experience in 3 states, California being one of them. At one time, their landlord-tenant laws were such that it would take legally approximately 90 days to evict the tenant or unsatisfactory tenancy, whether it was for delinquency of rent or for any other reason. The only problem was that through charges and countercharges, this could extend up as high as 90 months. There have been many instances in which a tenant would remain in a property going through FEG actions for as high as 9 months, being originally 2 to 3 months behind his rent, which would make a total of about a year of no income to that property. It was finally realized how many people were actually going bankrupt or are having their property foreclosed on because of this. And 2 years ago, effective November the 13th of 2 years ago, laws were finally passed that bring them equal to the existing Florida laws as far as FED or Forcible Entry and Wrongful Detainer Acts. They can now evict in 13 days, the same as Oregon. But if you have a written lease, again, there must be a lease. If it's on a month-to-month tenancy, again, I emphasize that this is a very, it's a necessary thing, but it's a very small bundle of rights.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Is this Twilliger? Is this the next name? Is that?
This is a series of bills for 1643, 1644, 1645, and another bill I believe that was 1680 something. But anyway, and that one was heard here a couple of days ago in one of the committees. Now there's been legislation like this for a number of years in New York City, and it is known as the Spiegel Ordinance. And this legislation is typed a lot like that. As a matter of fact, in the last session of the legislature, we had the same group down here advocating the passage of that type of an ordinance. And at that time, there was a piece came out on television while the legislature was in session of a tenant in New York City who had been operating under this particular type of legislation. She operated as a renter. And she was living in an apartment. They had tried to evict her. She had been living there 26 months without paying any rent, and she was still in the apartment. Now, her picture was on television. So you can see how well it works out. Now, in addition to that, in the last few years in New York City, there have been over 25,000 apartment houses and rentable structures abandoned. Because they couldn't, they have rent control to start in, so they held the rents down artificially. And in addition, they have used the bills where you have to repair the property. And people just simply have walked away and abandoned the property. And most of it has gone back to city on taxes. That also wipes out the mortgagees and twists the wrist. Now, you know the conditions in New York City now. They're on the verge of bankruptcy. They had trouble with their policemen, they've had trouble with their firemen, because they just don't have the money. If you go ahead and operate a government, and it's going to be a problem. The state is asking federal help. And we don't want to bring a condition like that on in Oregon. But that is the result of this type of legislation. Anyone is a potential landlord that owns a piece of property. If a woman owns a house, and she rents it out, she's a landlord. Now here, about 20 some years ago, and when I was more active in the industry, at that time, the average ownership of an apartment house in
in the United States consisted of 5 units or less, and in the large cities, in New York City, at that time, there were almost as many apartment houses in New York City as there were, that is, apartments, individual apartments, as there were in the rest of the United States put together. So you see, your land is scarce, your buildings are large, and you have a lot of tenants. And you just can't afford the individual homes in a city like that, nor can you afford small buildings. So at that time, that the average was built up by New York City. And now things have changed somewhat. And the average ownership of rental property in the United States today is less than 10 units. I would say in Oregon, probably the average ownership of rental property, that is residential rental property, is probably at least less than 5 units, because we don't compare them with our cities. So those are the types of people we're talking about that will be hurt for this bill more than any other group. And a good many of those owe money on their properties. And if they have to make payments and people would hold the rent, they'll live in the property, the same as they've got to do in California. If you just permit these strikes, people are providing the most valuable thing anyone can have, and that is shelter. They also have the privilege of paying the taxes to support the schools. That includes grade schools, high schools, and even a large part of the cost of the new community colleges are borne by the taxpayer. And as a general rule, the tenants, what he contributes is through his rent. Now this, of course, if it goes through, I'm sure it will bring the cost of rent higher. Bring the availability of mortgage money on this type of property harder to get because of the less desirability of owning property. So I think it's a very dangerous bill, and it'll do great harm to this country. And as it spreads around, if it does, over different parts of the United States, it will reduce the construction of housing everywhere, which in turn will affect us here in Oregon because lumber is our principal industry, and that's what goes into construction. So I think it ought to be left in committee, but I don't. It's been here before. It was in the last session of legislature. It didn't get out of committee, and it shouldn't get out of committee now. And when you get into it and study it, why it has many dangerous indications. There's another thing in here where it attempts to set up equitable jurisdiction in any case that comes before a court of law. Now your circuit courts have equitable. But your district courts do not. And equitable jurisdiction simply means that the judge can decide. He doesn't have to pay any attention to the law. He just decides what he considers fair and just. Well, now, that's where the legal aid can step in and keep the boys busy. They have quite a group working there, and it's natural that they want to keep themselves busy because there would be no justification for their existence there. They didn't have time to do that. And they're the ones pushing it, and they're to be the chief beneficiaries of it. But it'd be pretty hard on the poor, and I might say who the average landlord is. It's generally a woman past middle age who saves up something for her old age to take care of her and not have to live on her neighbors. And she's out trying to make a living. She rents the apartment, she cleans them up, she loses her rent once in a while, she pays her taxes, and she has a pretty rough time of it. Now that is the average landlord, and that is, if we eliminate that name landlord, and just call them property owners, or some similar name, or homeowner, I don't think that this kind of legislation would be here, because when you speak of landlord, that conjures up the old feeling and story of the feudal system of England. And it's an archaic term that should be abolished. If we had it abolished, we wouldn't have this kind of legislation to come down here and fight every section of legislation. Well, I'd like to submit a question on that. Who
am I? I'm just going to make it a statement question. Let's assume that the tenants have a problem, and let's assume the landlords have a problem. We've established, I think, in this hearing, there is a process of recourse for the tenant. How effectively that works really has not been established. If they do not have a well-established recourse right now, I think maybe we ought to direct ourselves to that issue for one. Number two, I can't feel justified in my own mind that it's all the landlord's fault, but we, I think, have determined there are some landlords who are at fault. Okay, assuming those things are true, how can we take House Bill 1654 and make it workable, or can we? Maybe I'll put it right there.
Well, of course, you know, half of your trouble comes when you go to a victim center for non-payment of rent, or half of it comes before you get to the eviction process. You can't pay the rent, well, then you start figuring out some way that he can, that he stay on until he can get some money to get another place or something. And generally, people don't evict people for non-payment of rent. I've been in this business for almost, for over 25 years. I've owned the present building I have for over 24 years. And I've only brought one eviction proceeding since I owned the building, and that was in the last few months, because I had a dope addict in the building who was peddling. And he was peddling it to Washington High School. He was also peddling it out at the MacGyver Park, and one had the Vortex over at the Washougal. We've done pretty big business. We had a string of people running in and out of the building. Of course, we immediately advised the police. And they wanted to get a hard sale there. A sale where they could get a conviction. He'd been convicted four times for burglary, use of a gun in a holdup, or a knockout, and selling hard narcotics, and I don't remember what the other charge was, but they even told me. It's a hard job. What a job to get him out of there, rather expensive, too.
I should have asked the question this way. Let's assume we have some unscrupulous landlords and some unscrupulous tenants. Now, how do we best take care of those that we want to direct us to?
Well, I know you have unscrupulous people in all walks of life. You have people that kill other people. You have people that rob other people. But how can you pass a law to prevent it? We're trying to do it now. But just simply passing a law won't stop it. It won't stop people from robbing other people, won't stop people from killing other people. And it's something that we don't like it, but we live with it, and I don't know how you're going to stop it. If you can figure out something, well, somebody will figure out another way to get around it.
You realize, of course, you're going to keep having this bill come back every session until that.
Well, I know. We don't like to have to come down here all the time either. It takes time from my work. I don't like to come down here. It takes time from these other people's work. As long as we have the legal aid, we'll have it down there, I'm sure of that. But I think they're going to abolish that.
I have one question, Mr. Chairman. What are we going to call the landlords if we change their name?
Well, I don't know, but you ought to be called something more fun than the landlord. People don't like that.
You won't tell you.
No, nobody likes the landlord, the banker, or the pawnbroker. They all take the money from them, and when they get through it, all they have left is a rent receipt or a memory. So that's a hard name to live on. But you remember, everyone that owns a home or a piece of ground is a potential landlord, just the moment he tries to rent it. And so that affects the vast majority. Most of your tenants are good people. And most of them that I've had over the years have been very fun people. They're my bread and butter. They're my best friends. I don't want to hurt them. If I hurt them, I put myself out of business. So you have to treat people right. But when you rent a house or rent an apartment, the first thing you do is show it to people. And generally the damage that's inflicted in that apartment is generally put on by the people who are doing the complaining themselves. And they'll do it generally through spite. But it seldom happens. I've had it happen.
One of the members of the committee says he's out of grass at the moment. Do you know where your last tenant moved to? Thank you very much for coming down. We appreciate you taking your time away from
us. I thought he meant he's the guy he kicked out.
It was. I'm going to hear two more people on this before we close the hearing for today, and they're both in favor of the bill. All the rest of the testimony is negative, and we'll take it up at the next hearing if the people want to come back. The two in favor of the bill, the first one will be Mr. Collins. not a member of the Legal Aid Society.
No, I'm not. My name is Kev Collins. I reside at 2103 Northeast Morgan Street in Portland, Oregon. And I'm the director of the Social Action Commission of the Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon. I'd like to mention that two of the members of that commission, Mr. John Mann, the vice chairman, and Mr. Myron Fleck, are here in attendance today. Our commission moved and passed unanimously to support House Bill 1645. In the interest of time, Representative Ingalls, I'll try to be very brief.
Thank you, sir.
I would mention, however, that we are maybe some of the people that have problems with idealism and feel that this bill would do some significant things for giving tenants some rights. On a personal level, I've had some experiences as being a tenant three times over a 6-year period. Also, I've had some experience being a landlord as dean of students in a college setting, the 5 dormitory buildings, and also, as I suppose, a legal aid type of working with students who were renting off-campus facilities and trying to help them when they occasionally encountered unscrupulous landlords. I suppose, too, we could be viewed as having dreams of some of these well-meaning individuals. But I would like to object to the point that we are not the same group that was here last time. We take exception to that, and I think a number of the other supporters of this measure, this trip off, would likewise. One other item I would like to touch on is that it seems to me we're becoming more and more and more a tenant society. I was interested in the representative of a number of agencies, including, you mentioned Cooley and Company. I happen to know Bill Cooley very well, and his operation, where they are building large units in suburban areas. And I think this illustrates rather well the point I want to make, that more people are becoming tenants, rich and poor. And I think it cries out to give them rights as citizens, some tenants' rights, as this bill will propose to do. I would hope, and of course I say this for our committee, that you will let this out of your committee with a strong do pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. We appreciate your testimony, both in its brevity and its logic. We'll hear from Peter Dern, is it? If you please.
I will try to skip on some of the things that have been covered. I would also perhaps like to ask for this by accident being late in the session. Answering a couple of things which occurred to me in the week. My name is Peter Dane. I'm from Portland, a social worker. I represent the Joint Council for Social Welfare and Education. I can speak I somehow it escapes me that if a person is selling something which is meant to live in, that it's perfectly okay to sell it. It's not good to live in as long as you don't charge too much for it. I failed to see the logic of that argument. And the other part of it that bothers me is that, at least in my experience, and I do have some friends who are also on the landlord side of the thing, and I have, in my work, dealt with many real estate agents who are running to my clients, that I can yet not remember one single instance where somebody is selling any property in poor condition was not making pretty good money. I've known some people who went bankrupt to be in real estate. If they weren't selling bad property, they weren't doing bad property. They were trying to do their job. So maybe we have a strange business where you can only make money if you do a bad job. I'm not sure that that's a useful kind of business. In my prepared statement, I cited an example which is very vivid in my memory. This is the second family I ever visited in my career. And the situation illustrated one of the biggest problems that was mentioned here, the matter of recourse. Drain field, septic tank didn't work, the porch had broken board, the plaster was falling down. The toilet ran through continuously. I didn't mention all of them, there were many others. And I asked the lady, you know, maybe I have to land or fix it again three times. He hasn't done anything in 2 months. Why don't you complain to the health department about the drain field? The neighbors told me the last sentence. He was giving notice to move. And then a little bitter smile, I'm stuck until I have enough to afford to move again. And this is really what it comes down to. And let's say that the landlord doesn't evict you, and you complain to the health department, well, and the health department evicts you. Now, it would be very fine if we had an ample supply of low-cost housing for people who don't have much money. One of the members of this committee was on the welfare task force, remembers the figures about what kind of income people have. You know, a family of four gets about $200. Assuming that the figure previously cited of around $100 for typical dwelling is applicable, and probably is, their leeway, their possibilities for looking for someplace else, the kind of choice that they have, is essentially none. They don't have anywhere to move. Are basically stuck, so the only recourse they have basically is to sit there and take it, which is what most of them do. And the frustrating thing to somebody working with them is that I can't do anything about it. And I remember many instances where I initiated something with the health department or fire department or whatever else it was. And only to receive a call from my clients that either my order had thrown them out or the health department is going on. So I hadn't really solved anything because they still didn't have a decent place to live. And I feel that this bill will go a long way towards it, and I'd like to put particular emphasis on my last item, a little summary at the end. That has to do with the question of retaliation or raising a rent. It really doesn't, in my judgment, as an attorney, doesn't help a great deal to give people all sorts of rights, give them all sorts of recourse. The consequence is that they lose out on the place they live in. You provide beautiful procedures, and if the landlord can show you out or you can raise the rent 50% and make things from you out if you haven't got the money, then it all doesn't mean much. And I sympathize with the problem for the landlord who's stuck with a bad tenant. But realistically, you know, if one of my clients, workers, and other similar workers, goes in court and he's in a contest with the owner of property, even if their rights are equal, and even if there's an equitable situation, I have a very hard time feeling sorry for the property owner because his capacity is skills, has access to resources, access to rehabilitation, and left out of the context. It's so garden, that probably my clients will still lose most of the time, and perhaps instead of losing 99 out of 100, maybe they only lose 2 out of 3. That'd be a pretty good goal if that could be accomplished. I'd be happy to answer your question, but I apologize for departing from my prepared statement. That was partly in response to previous testimony.
What instead of withholding the rent, we had it deposited to some other third party or something, would that help?
I think that would be eminently acceptable. I'm
eminently what?
I'm not sure I understand why some of the different changes that were proposed are in separate bills. One of the other bills has been proposed providing specifically for that. I would feel very strongly that in my job, I would be doing a gross disservice to
I wasn't going to suggest it be deposited to the Legal Aid Society.
I would assume that the court that has jurisdiction in the matter ultimately would be the right place to deposit it. I'm not an attorney.
Are there any questions? I appreciate very much your testimony. I appreciate all, yes.
I had forgotten this and missed this briefly.
Yes, we'd like to have it, Mr. Collins.
It was a statement of testimony of a man who couldn't hear, Mr. Louis Reynolds, one half a page. Could I read it quickly?
Did we not have testimony for him on his behalf by Pastor Brody?
I don't believe he was here.
No, I think the
man's
testimony.
No, we have the testimony already, I think.
No,
they're not the same.
Oh, they're not? This is.
May I?
Yes, if you will, please.
First, let me say,
what's the
Mr. Testimony of Louis Reinhold.
Oh, this, is he the brother of Richard?
He's a relative.
Okay.
Hospital 1645. First, let me say that I regret that circumstances do not permit my being here in person to testify for Bill 1645. My name is Louis Reinhold, and I reside at 1802 Southeast 176th Avenue in Port Glory. I have been in the business of renting dwellings for the past 10 years. I also hold interest in mobile courts. I think you will all agree that some kind of legislation to protect the tenant from unscrupulous landlords is long overdue. To date, there is no recourse for the tenant living in substandard conditions to bring his living conditions up to the standards of all the bylaw. I urge that you give a due pass to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. I appreciate all of your coming, and I know your interest in the bill is sincere, and we will have another hearing at a later date. And I'm going to close the hearing for this afternoon. Thank you very much.